Welcome to the ONC PCOR Research Data User Scenarios Workgroup Meeting Number 5. My name is Hilda, and I will be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants' lines are unmuted. Please self-mute your lines. If you wish to ask a question, please use the WebEx to raise your hand or send your questions to Catherine Donaldson via the chat function. If you are not signed into WebEx and wish to ask a question, please announce yourself on the phone, stating your name and your affiliation. Please also note that this conference is being recorded. I will now turn the call over to Priscilla Dula.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. So this is sort of our first meeting of the multi-stakeholder group. This is Priscilla, and joining me from NORC, I have Eric Oppelroot, Lauren Gargan, and Catherine. We have our colleagues from George Washington University on the line, Jane Thorpe, Laura Cartwright-Smith, Elizabeth Gray. We have other team members, including Daniela Mika and Joanna Singerano on. And then we also have our sponsors, ONC, on, both Helen Caton-Peters and Davy Massa. So I see there's lots of folks joining the line. I'm not going to actually call out anyone by name. We will take note of everyone who participated, both in terms of folks that dialed into the call as well as individuals that signed into the WebEx. Okay. So just to get us started today, the focus here continues to be, at least, in this part of the project, on developing research data use scenarios that we're hearing from the multi-stakeholder group. And for the call today, there's sort of, four main things that we're going to focus on. So we've actually, since the time that we met with you last, developed two new scenarios, one on sort of the idea of longitudinal consent, consenting children and adults, and as they age into sort of a different age group, what are the implications around consent for research? And the other is on vulnerable populations. And the focus on this discussion will be to share sort of the actual scenarios that we developed, and then also discuss, some key questions that are sort of surfacing from our exploration of the scenario, and Daniela will take you through those. And then we will do an update for the group on, scenarios that we've discussed with you previously, so we'll walk through those. On this call, I'm sort of just cueing everyone, we are really very interested in gathering new scenarios that we can work with you on further developing. So throughout the discussion today, if there's sort of any new scenarios that you are thinking of or information that we're presenting that, suggests to you that there might be other ways to sort of explore a particular issue, please feel free to raise your hands and let us know. Okay? And then we'll sort of wrap up with some additional scenarios that we are working on, and then with some sort of process and logistic updates, okay? So just very briefly, we've shared the slide on all of the prior calls, but really when we are developing each of these research data use scenarios, we are sort of targeting these key question areas. And even after we sort of, have worked with the scenarios, the GW team are sort of going back to each of these and are looking through them sort of with a finer eye in making sure that we cover these areas. So this is just mostly a reminder to everyone on the call that these are sort of, pertinent and relevant questions to each of the scenarios that we're working on. Okay. So the first scenario that we are going to be discussing in a little more detail is consenting children and adolescents, which is scenario number 4. And Daniela, I'm going to hand it over to you now as I bring up the scenario, okay? Over to you.
Thanks, Priscilla. So this is the very detailed text of this scenario you see on the screen now. And I think that the motivation for bringing this up is some of the complexities that we have as we start embarking on projects where we have longitudinal studies that might involve a complex mixture of stakeholders, ranging from data providers from the health systems as well as providers that are making proxy consents on behalf of children and adolescents. So we're sort of setting this up, the first two paragraphs of this. I won't read through this in great detail, but what the scenario is setting forward is that there is a federally qualified health center that is separate from the research organization that that the researcher is affiliated with, that is participating in the longitudinal study. The IRB for the researchers institution has approved a protocol that involves a number of different terms of consent, but most importantly for the purposes of children and adolescents, the parent or legal guardian is consenting on behalf of the minor to release the medical records as well as other data that might be collected over the course of the study. So I assume that there is a number of people on the call that have found themselves in this scenario before, and I would be very interested in your thoughts on challenges that you guys may have encountered in getting these kinds of IRBs approved, as well as understanding, you know, the ins and outs of getting the parents to consent on behalf of patients and concerns on behalf of their children and concerns that they might be bringing up that are related to privacy specifically. And rather than things like procedures. So, and one of the challenges in this situation that we encountered was developing a better understanding about what the responsibility of the covered entities were versus the research community in terms of managing what happens when the minor comes of age. So, we have an understanding that the legal age of consent is going to vary state by state. So the researchers, if they're working on a multi-state, multi-site project, would have to manage those kinds of changes. And the protocols would generally include some kind of activity that would be triggered by the minor reaching an age of consent, whether that was a re-consent or the opportunity to opt out or some notification that they had been engaged in the study and that their data was being released from the covered entity on an ongoing basis in terms of a particular protocol that involves that kind of longitudinal data release. And so these are the kinds of things that might be put into a protocol and approved by an IRB that have to be managed on an ongoing basis by the research community and potentially the covered entity. So those were the kinds of things that were coming up in the course of this discussion. And so the questions that I wanted to get your feedback on were related to these issues on who is responsible and what kinds of things are both ethical and legal in the context that you've experienced the consent for data release on behalf of a minor and what happens when they come of age. So. The first question that we have here is how often is the covered entity, so let's say it's the Children's Hospital of Los Angeles, how frequently is the covered entity or the researcher required to obtain consent? Is it an ongoing basis? Is it only triggered by a change in the legal status of the participant? Is there a difference between opt-in and opt-out options that are given to patients? These kinds of things, on an ongoing basis, a perpetual basis, questions that you may have encountered in your research. And when in reading about different kinds of standards and best practices, we found that there were some differences between whether assent or consent were required and the extent to which there might be a dual responsibility. So the kind of scenario that had come to mind in these cases is, you know, What if there is an adolescent that disagrees with their parent, so they would not be giving assent, and the legal guardian, the parent, would still have the ability to provide consent on behalf of their child, where assent might not actually be in place. So that issue was a concern, and how we manage that kind of information electronically in a way that would allow us to handle the data potentially differently if there was a change in the agreement between the parent and the child that was not yet an adult. And so if there has been some kind of consent revoked, and we covered this a little bit before, but it might be different. It might be different when we're discussing what the obligations are to protect the rights of minors versus the rights of adults. How do we handle the changes in data flow that might occur? And so is it different? Do we consider things to be different for a minor versus an adult here? And then again, if we can't obtain the consent, are there any laws that are addressing this at the state level, and what needs to be done with data that's already been processed and potentially released to researchers for use after consent has been withdrawn? And finally, you know, there's just this general issue that we have with information systems on, given that they're not perfect and they're likely to encounter problems, who is responsible for adjudicating any mishaps in the release, given that this is a particularly complex situation where there may be dual responsibility between the covered entity and the researcher for managing the release and the stewardship of the data as consent status as a ability to consent may change. So if you can move the slide down a little bit, please. We sort of have the high level description of what we've been working on in this. The preconditions here are things that we've kind of discussed before. The IRB has approved things. Any of the data requests have been combined with unique identifiers. There's assumptions of how the data will be transferred to the data holders. Nothing that different from what we've discussed in prior meetings in the preconditions. And the postconditions are that the data coordinator receives both the consent information and updated versions of the consent information, that the covered entity is going to continue to transmit the information, and that the researcher is going to continue to send any information to people that are able to conduct research. And this, you know, we have these two alternatives here, and among others that we'd like to hear from you. So the disagreement between the parent and the child, and the particular case where a patient that's come of age would like to revoke their records or revoke them under some specific circumstances that may be more complex than what the original information systems were intended to manage. So these are the kinds of things that we were considering with this. I know that there's some of you on the call that have been doing research in pediatric populations, and I'm particularly interested in hearing what you guys have to say about your experience in this particular scenario.
I'm sorry. I was going to say Leslie Francis has a question, but I'll let you finish up, and then we can ask Leslie to ask a question. Okay.
I was literally just opening it up for questions now. So.
Okay, this is Leslie. I just wanted to point out that something you're going to have to layer on top of this is that in some states, adolescents have different levels of control over different types of information. So you may have to pay special attention to any reproductive information, any information about sexually transmitted diseases, or any information in some states about mental health treatment. So it's not going to be an all or nothing on information, even in a particular state.
And so I think that one thing that has been fairly interesting about the variations across states is that in the regulatory arenas is that even if it's not a federal policy, there's probably some underlying ethical concerns that are driving those policies that we might want to take into account for the purposes of the discussion that we have here. So, you know, different IRBs may take those considerations into account even if they're not legally binding in the state that they're in. So I think that any additional detail on that seems like it would be quite valuable to the team here.
It's really a state-by-state question. I have some of that research that I could send you.
That would be great.
Leslie, thanks. We'll follow up with you on that, okay?
Yep.
I wanted to ask Lucy Jones. You have your hands up. Please go ahead and ask your question. or comment.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Thank you. I wanted to, I regret to say, introduce a complication for which I have no answer, but I find the concept of parent to be something more complicated than it appears in this write-up. What if parents disagree? Or what if one parent gives consent and a divorced parent hears about it? Or one parent gives consent and they're not even divorced, but the other parent challenges. I just was wondering whether the potential for disagreement about parental consent should be mentioned as something that IRBs and researchers may have to deal with. They don't want to end up in court about this.
Great point. Yeah, I think we had sort of put into this disagreement between the child and the parent, but not between two different parents. And definitely something that we wanted to put in here as an alternative.
Okay. Yeah, we can put the evidence as an alternative. Go ahead.
This is Jim Walker.
Go ahead, Jim.
In a different context, this is managing children's access to their electronic record, their patient health record. But I think it might be a useful general principle here. We just concluded after actually hundreds of hours of legal review that if there was disagreement between parents and whatever definition that was, step parents, whatever, or if there was disagreement between the child and the parent, we just canceled all access, feeling that trying to adjudicate things like that is, not much use, and that just kept things cleaner. And I think even for research, it would be more of the case that any of those disagreements would make it smart to just withdraw the patient's information.
And how much did you guys take into account in that deliberation whether or not the research would actually benefit the participant in that case? Because I know that's a stipulation that we've had, at least at my organization, if there's not a direct benefit to the participant in these cases, it's called into question, or at least it's a higher level of analysis of risk. How did you guys talk about that particular issue?
Well, again, we weren't in a research setting. This is just children's access to their record. But the research literature is littered with cases where it was obvious to everyone that being in the study was beneficial or not beneficial, and everybody was wrong. So I think that would be a difficult criterion to establish and use.
So I wanted to ask, say, our colleagues at GW, Jane and Lana, did you have any comment on this at all? I mean, we can certainly sort of, you know, discuss this more offline, but I just wanted to know if you had any sort of guidance here.
All I will say is these issues do vary from state to state. It's entirely a matter of state law, and generally it would depend on which parent has custody. So, you know, the questions of medical decision-making for a child will be, you know, either by under state statute or regulation, or sometimes, you know, parents have gone to court over it. So, it's not something that would necessarily be something we would spell out in the framework, but we could certainly flag that issue. But if there's research scenarios and places where this comes up where it would be an important thing to highlight, absolutely please let us know or share the details.
So were there any other, so Danielle sort of teed up, you know, some of the key questions. I mean, are there other questions we ought to consider? And other alternate scenarios as well. And I'm just going to sort of, you know, so these are the questions that you see in front of you. And right now we have these two alternate scenarios sort of articulated. But is there anything else, at least from, you know, your vantage, we should be thinking about? Lucy, did you have another comment? I see your hand up, and I just want to know if you had another
comment. I just had another thought. If there's more than one FQHC, just as a use case, if there's more than one at issue, is it assumed that there's only one consent for the total study, no matter the number of sites, or does every site have to obtain consent? I guess that's a point of information.
Yeah, actually, I want the GW team to weigh in on this, because we had talked about the most current regulations on whether the research consent could be reused for both research and the covered entity, and I believe this is closely related to that issue. So I don't know if somebody on GW wants to talk about how that's changed in recent years.
Lara Jane, can we ask you to respond?
I could envision a circumstance, for example, where if there are two possible providers equidistant from place of residence, but one closer to place of work, and we're talking about children here, that the parent might use two sites for regular care, hopefully electronically connected, but we all know that's hopeful. So I'm just wondering how it would work when more than one site is at issue.
So I don't know, Lara and Jane, can you hear us? I don't know if you guys are on mute. Okay, you know, we'll come back to this. I know we had a sort of internal conversation, and I think there is sort of, you know, some additional information here that might be helpful. I don't think our GW colleagues are able to sort of share that right now.
Thank you.
Sure. Any other questions or comments? Okay, I'm going to move us on to the next scenario, okay? And I'm just bringing it up.
Okay, and I don't know if we reminded people that they're certainly welcome to submit anything that occurs to them offline. I think with that scenario with the parent and child, there's probably some other things that people might think about related to genomics or other kinds of things where there might be some shared privacy concerns, and we didn't address that at length in that particular scenario, but that might be something that people that are interested in precision medicine might have some thoughts on as well, for things that we might want to address in that scenario.
Okay, no, thank you, Danielle. Yeah, I was going to cue everyone again later, but I appreciate you sort of, you know, cueing folks now as well.
Okay, I'll just keep on reminding people, and hopefully they won't get too bored.
Yeah, no, sounds good.
So the other area, and you sort of see the theme of this week, is sort of trying to address special populations and the different kinds of things that come up when we're dealing with special populations in longitudinal studies. And so in the prior case, we were thinking especially about the concerns of minors and coming of age, and when we're talking about consent. I think that this one is dealing with other kinds of vulnerable populations, and what we're sort of exploring here are cases where we would be recruiting both normal participants and vulnerable populations in the interest of capturing some kind of representative cohort in a longitudinal study. So we assume in general that there's going to be a coordination between a medical covered entity and some research entity that need to come together in an agreement that is covered by an IRB with a particular protocol in mind. And in this case, the protocol is going to have a number of special provisions around how to address vulnerable populations. And there's a number of things that we expect will be collected in these cases, and baseline surveys, exams, biospecimens, but in general, we're expecting there to be informed consent. And because the expectation is that people may be coming in and out of vulnerable populations, We assume that the IRB would have to approve some kind of aspect of the protocol for how patients that are unable to consent on their own behalf will get assurances from a legally appointed proxy or someone that is authorized in order to provide consent. And the documents have a number of required components related to ability to withdraw participation and a way of recontacting on a regular basis the participants so that they can opt out of the research if they're interested in opting out. So some of the things that are coming up when we're talking about vulnerable populations have to do with their ability to have the decision making capability in order to make those opt out decisions in a way that is more proactive, as well as the original consent, and if they were consented into the study at a time when they were decisionally impaired, and then recover decision making abilities, how those kinds of circumstances are handled. So there's this set of questions here are related to how we should be documenting that information. So should the information systems have some ability in place to document the status of an individual's membership in a special population? How should we be capturing that, and the extent to which we expect a change in status from membership in a population, in one special population, to a normal population and back potentially into a special population? And what is the responsibility of the covered entity in this case? So how is the covered entity responsible if they identify that a patient that was participating in the study has encountered a health condition that would actually change their ability to give ongoing consent? So if a patient had had a disabling stroke, for example, would the covered entity be responsible for signaling to the research team that the patient's risk profile and membership in a vulnerable population had changed? And there's these scenarios that might happen where a patient becomes part of a vulnerable population, and incarceration was an important special vulnerable population, and how the research team can manage those kinds of scenarios where they might have changed the ability for the participant to give consent without incurring additional ethical problems in the common rule, but also potentially other kinds of scenarios. And then this issue of trying to have an annual opt out, understanding what the obligations are if they can't contact a patient, and how the opt out process should be documented, and so if there's changes in impairment, how well or how much responsibility does the research team have in this annual basis to verify the cognitive status of the patient. So I think that we can kind of pause there, because the rest of the description is fairly similar to what we've talked about before. We can scroll down and look at the alternatives to see if those capture the things that people are interested in looking at, and also sort of documentation of the special population so that people can see what are considered to be special populations in this case. So I open up again to the group to see what their comments are. Sorry.
Let's go ahead.
So this is Leslie. There is some concern about calling some of these populations vulnerable. That's just a bit of a PC comment. But leaving that aside and looking specifically at some of these kinds of populations, there's a large push in the disability community, particularly involving people with intellectual disabilities or mental illness that affects decision-making capabilities, to think about supported decision-making models. And the way you have it all presented here, it's got an all or nothing. And our concern is to document which way it is. And I'm happy offline to talk to you more about how to introduce some of that subtlety.
Can I ask you to expand on that, just to make sure I understand the point a little bit more? Is that there may be some, there may be some multiple shades of how someone might be participating in what levels? Am I getting your comment right that there's, you know, this isn't black or white, and you might have to do things a little bit differently depending on where someone might fall on a spectrum, but our system should capture that kind of information so that we're able to give the appropriate decision-making authority when with the understanding of different levels of capacity. So right. Is that your...
Yeah. And it may be, for example, a not unusual suggestion is that it ought to be shared. So on a shared model, both actually have to agree. But you need a kind of cooperative consent.
So you're suggesting then that the consent would be shared as well with all the covered entities. So there's one consent they can all refer to. Okay.
Right. So don't think about it as either the person decides for him or herself, or we just hand it over to somebody else. There's a lot of discussion of that in the literature. I don't want to take, you know, your time, but I can fill you in on that offline.
So Leslie, this is Priscilla. That sounds good. I mean, I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, given what Daniela has just presented here, and based on some of the work you're doing, you know, do you think we should craft up a separate scenario that sort of focuses on this idea of, you know, cooperative consent? My words, you know, we'll think of the right words in talking to you.
Well, one way to think about it is you actually might not want to have a single scenario for a, quote, variety of vulnerable populations, mm-hmm. but you might want to have a separate scenario for people with cognitive or other kinds of decisional impairments, and another kind of scenario, for example, where pregnancy is involved or non-English-speaking populations are involved.
Okay.
This is Jim. Just to sort of tag on to that, three of these categories are black and white and are very easy to calculate. Minors, pregnant women, and neonates. Those are all time-based. And so that's one, and they don't move back and forth. Well, pregnant women move back and forth, but the other two don't move back and forth between the two states. So some of them are very clearly defined and easy to calculate, easy to track in standard electronic information systems. And then others are not very subject to change, which is another sort of filter you can put on these and say, well, adults not competent to consent. There wouldn't be enough adults not competent who became competent to affect any study population that I can think of. And then non-English speaking, you know, maybe someone, you know, there's some movement out of that population, although again, it's probably fairly small actually among adults. And whatever movement there is doesn't seem like it would put any additional strain on consent. I mean, if the consent was done well, when the patient needed a translator, it's not clear that their being able to speak English would require reconsent, and it's especially not clear that you'd be able to pick up any signal in the system that would tell you that had happened. So I think you could sort of parse these into logical groups that would have different scenarios and different sort of needs.
Okay, very helpful. Thank you. Other comments? Jason, go ahead. I see your hand is raised.
Yeah, I was just going to add that a lot of times in research where adult patients can't consent, and it's due to some sort of neurologic problem. There's a public hearing that's held to decide whether and to get opinions and to decide whether it's appropriate to include their data or deliver a treatment. I'm not sure that that would apply broadly here, but it could if there was, for example, important data needed on how to treat head injury or head trauma, but people couldn't consent because they were unconscious, and you could hold a public hearing to see if anyone objected to using their data when they were unconscious. They didn't have anyone who could consent for them. That's all.
Thank you.
Would that be with respect to a particular patient or with respect to sort of a population for a particular study?
So it would be with respect to a particular population, and it could be with respect to an entire data network, though mostly it's been used with respect to a particular study where they want to deliver interventions to patients who can't consent. But if you felt strongly that there was data in observational data that was useful or could become useful in helping to treat people who are unconscious from a head injury, for example, in a data network, then you could hold a public hearing to see if it was appropriate to include their data. And that's just one approach that's been used.
So that's kind of this shared consent writ quite large is sort of a sort of more of a forum based approach to authorizing release. From
right.
The sound of it, so we have the very narrow example of possibly the individual and a proxy sharing consent, or possibly two parents. That this is something that would be even more broad and different from an IRB, I guess. It sounds like this is something where an IRB wouldn't feel comfortable making the decision without a public forum.
That's right. So usually the IRB requires the public forum or the hearing to make sure the community agrees that this is appropriate, and then there's some sort of report, and then the IRB says approves or disapproves the use of the data when the patient can't consent.
We have two folks that have their hands raised. Lucy, do you want to go ahead? And then Luchella after her. Okay. Go ahead, Lucy.
Thank you. It seems to me the history of experimentation on prisoners suggests that prisoners are more than a special or vulnerable population. Prisoners are deprived of rights by policy, and the issue of consent of prisoners seems to me incredibly complex because of that. And that does distinguish them, at least in my mind, from the other categories here, all of whom have rights which they may not be able to exercise due to age or incapacity. But prisoners can't exercise their rights as a matter of policy. So I'm uncomfortable putting them in the category of a special population, as though thinking about a bunch of special populations is sufficient to address the issue of consent with prisoners. I think it would be a better idea to treat prisoners as a separate category altogether, distinguished uniquely from all others by the imposition of policy on their rights. So I don't think they belong here, and I'm not pretending to have an answer to how to deal with that. I just don't think they belong here because they're so different from all the other categories, and the history of exploitation is blatant, and this project wants to be sure that it registers that you're aware of this history of exploitation and you're not suggesting that a generalized one-size-fits-all for any reason works with prisoners.
I think the Office of Human Subjects Protection agrees with you, and they have a different path for prisoners from these other populations. So I think that's well taken.
Okay. Go ahead.
Hello, this is Eric Gopplerud. I think the whole general issue of people who are under court supervision needs to be addressed. Not just those who are prisoners, but probation, parole, and others who are under administrative court jurisdiction. And we do have a draft use case that we're developing.
Thank you. Luciana, go ahead.
I was going to comment on those who cannot consent because I did survey a while ago. The consent procedures for emergency medicine had trauma patients, and this is for interventional trials and so on. And it looked to me that mostly it's by proxy. And so I haven't heard of this process that Jason had referred to. And I would think, you know, for data sharing, it would be much less triggering of such mechanism than interventional trials in other items. So that was one of observations. And as the discussion came along about the prisoners, I can also tell you that at least in some of our systems, it's very hard to know. And we learned one way of figuring out whether it's a prisoner or not is to look into the address, physical address, in the electronic health record data. And that's how we found out that some of our patients were prisoners. But it's very hard to flag it. So I don't know how other institutions do, but it's not an easy thing.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Luciana. I don't know if there's anyone on the phone that sort of, you know, has some other experience on how they may flag or identify who is a prisoner. Does anyone have some input? So it doesn't sound like anyone else has had this experience, you know, equally in the same way, but definitely something that, you know, if we gather some more information, we're happy to share. Okay, any other comments or observations on this? I thought this was actually quite helpful. I think it's given us some ideas on, you know, sort of alternative paths we can take and which sort of, you know, subset of you know, population groups we need to sort of explore further. So very helpful in that regard. Jenna, did you want to make any other comments before I sort of move us on a little?
No, I agree. It's very helpful, and it sounds like we have some more specific work to do around the incarcerated or paroled populations, and looking forward to working that out with this group.
Okay, great. Thank you. So there's still a few things that we want to get into, so I'm going to actually just go through a couple of things quickly. You know, we had actually intended on this call to talk briefly about sort of some of the updates that we've made on the previous scenarios, but I'm not going to belabor that now because, you know, there's actually what we really want to do is see if there's some other ideas for scenarios that we need to develop. So just very briefly, we have updated the scenarios based on some feedback that we've received from members from this group, as well as some internal deliberations. In the coming weeks, we will send out a link to the website where you will be allowed to you know, provide additional feedback as well, okay? But this is just to let you know that, you know, each week we're coming together and we're collecting some feedback and then, you know, iteratively we're refining. And then once, you know, we feel they refine fine enough, you know, we'll make sort of a formal call for feedback, okay? So then just very, very briefly on that. Okay, so just a few other things that have sort of bubbled up in prior calls. In terms of sort of additional scenarios that we have under development, you know, this whole idea of looking at sort of the re-identification risks as a consequence of the mosaic effect has sort of emerged on these conversations as well as some internal deliberations.
And so, you know, we are going to be working with the internal team to build that out. We've also, you know, we're also sort of exploring some of the privacy risks associated with collecting patient-reported outcomes, and there's some examples that we are going to build up on that. You know, on this call, it's sort of, as well as some other sort of discussions, we know this issue has come up about sort of what we call, you know, developing some kind of cross-institution identifier for research. And we are having some discussions with sort of the ONC groups that are involved with patient aggregation and matching linkage to explore what might be feasible here. Danielle, let me stop and see if you wanted to sort of put a finer point on this, you know, on the item on cross-institution identifier for research.
Sure. So, I mean, I think that there are probably a number of people on this call that we've spoken to offline or that have worked on this before in order to create longitudinal registries that span multiple organizations, an issue that Ed had brought up. I know that Lucilla and Jason have been very actively working on this issue and how we can create cross-institutional research identifiers and how important they are for doing research and potentially how important they are for protecting privacy in cases where the two alternatives are physically merging data versus physically keeping data separate but enabling certain techniques that allow us to analyze data without transferring it. So this issue and this different kinds of solutions to it are pretty broad, and getting feedback from this group on how to manage that, everything from a patient-centered approach where they would actually create authorization for a unique identifier that could be shared across different research organizations and covered entities, all the way through to heavily encrypted methods that may invoke certain provisions of HIPAA that are related to statistical certification, some of us have explored even more extreme scenarios of privacy-preserving identifiers. I think this issue is such a pragmatic issue for PCOR that while it's a little bit touchy and even in itself introduces some risks, it's also something that we probably have to or can't avoid exploring in what we're talking about. So I don't know if there's anybody that doesn't feel like this is a particularly important issue, but if you think this isn't important, I'd love to hear about why.
So thanks, Daniela. You know, I think we will be reaching out to certainly some members of the multi-stakeholder group that have explicitly brought this issue up with us, and we might convene in a slightly smaller forum, you know, between one of these calls, okay? So I'm going to actually pause here, and, you know, I think in prior calls, we've actually asked, you know, this group, you know, to see if you had any ideas or are sort of involved with, you know, some type of research that involves patient-generated health data. And we are looking to, you know, work with somebody on this group to, you know, who has some sort of interesting examples of the use of PJHD for PCOR. So I don't know if there's anyone on the call now that wanted to sort of share some of what they might be doing that you think might be worthy of, you know, further exploration through a data use research scenario. And then similarly, you know, while, you know, we've talked about sort of this idea of longitudinal consent as well as, you know, vulnerable populations, and I know, you know, there's sort of all these different categories under that, but there's definitely sort of, you know, these considerations when we think of the precision medicine initiative work as well. But in addition to that, we are also looking for, you know, specific examples of the use of genetic data for research and, you know, work that you might all be engaged in that might allow us to build out a scenario. So I'm going to stop here and just see if anyone has ideas that you want to share. Lucy, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to raise the possibility that there's a whole class of data collection entities called personal health record vendors that might look attractive to a researcher at some point. This is patient-generated health data, and these are the repositories for patient-generated health data. Health Vault at Microsoft is a very well-known example. And I just wanted to point out that the typical personal health record vendor is not subject to HIPAA, and the data that they collect are not protected by HIPAA. So I just wanted to point out, if you actually have any written text eventually about patient-generated health data, you might want to recognize that there are repositories of such data that might look very attractive, but there is a HIPAA issue with that data, and anybody trying to tap into it needs to recognize that and deal with it, because those firms are not HIPAA covered. They didn't exist, obviously, when the law was written, and they are not inclined to be covered by HIPAA. They have no inclination to go in that direction. It's too complicated for them. So these so-called patient-facing vendors are not covered, don't want to be covered, and therefore the data that they collect, attractive as it might look, might pose very special privacy and security concerns.
Thanks, Lucy. We will, you know, we'll take that into account. I mean, I think right now we are looking for sort of some ideas on, you know, what we can develop around patient-generated health data. I mean, there may be personal health record data, sensor data, you know, medical device, the personal medical device data. I don't know if there's anyone sort of, you know, involved in such type of work on this group, but, you know, we would be interested in hearing from you, you know, on a particular scenario that we can build out. Are there any ideas specifically from this group around, you know, precision medicine that we could sort of explore in more detail through a specific scenario? Leslie, go ahead.
What about family medical history information, where there might be implications for other people, but that might be tremendously useful for precision medicine? I know somebody who's working on that kind of thing, and I could talk to you about it offline.
Okay, and, you know, collecting family medical history for the purposes of PCOR, right? Is that what?
Right. Yeah, that's what I had in mind, but what's interesting about that is that if I give you my family medical history, I'm not just giving you information about myself.
Right. Yeah, I think we'd be very interested in exploring that further with you. So we can certainly sort of reach out outside of this call to, you know, get in touch with yourself and whomever else you have in mind.
This is Jim. An added wrinkle to what Leslie just mentioned is that it is feasible, at least in some settings, to link records, link the electronic records of two or more people together, mother and child or others. And that raises that whole set of issues in even probably a stronger way, because there the whole record is linked.
Yeah, could I add to that that when I asked somebody at OMC, not at OMC, at the Office of Civil Rights, whether the HIPAA treatment exception covered the use of my family members' linked records for my own treatment, so that would require family members' authorization or not, the answer I got was that was considered treatment, and so the family members' authorization was not required, which I found.
This is Karen Rothenberg. Just two little additional wrinkles to that, or information. First of all, there's the overlay of GINA with respect to that information, and if it's family medical history and it has genetic information in it, there's an overlay of that. And then more specifically with respect to precision medicine, there's a fantastic website that has been created by, I think, NIH or, I'm not sure, maybe the White House or maybe both. And there's a major report in there about some of the questions you're raising. And so that might be something you want to look at. And then one final suggestion on the genetics research stuff. I think it would be worth reaching out to Sarah Hull, H-U-L-L at the NIH, who runs the genetics research IRB and is really on top of all these issues.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, you know, the I think we do have a participant from the NIH on the call today, but, you know, we, ONCA has certainly been sort of interacting with staff at the NIH, so we sort of appreciate that input.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
They're doing a lot of work on these issues relative to the Precision Medicine Initiative, especially.
Mm-hmm. Sure, thank you. Okay, so... I know we're sort of coming up to the top of the hour. You know, on the website, through the sort of Confluence website, I think one of the members of this group had submitted a scenario on combining claims data and birth records. So I don't think we have time right now to go into it in much detail, but we have sent out the slides to everyone. And what we really wanted to sort of, you know, discuss with you all, one, you know, as a group, if this would be something that you felt would be worthy of sort of further exploration, because there are some sort of well-expressed, you know, sort of issues. So there's, you know, this researcher who wants to conduct PCOR on pregnant women using administrative claims data from insurers, and then, you know, as well as using birth certificates obtained from the state. So, again, I'm not sure exactly who submitted the scenario, but clearly this is something that they wanted to bring up for broader discussion. So when we meet next, we will certainly discuss this in more detail. But outside of that, if there's anyone who wanted to sort of reach out to us separately and have some ideas on how, you know, we can sort of expand on this, or, you know, consider other data sources such as APCD data, we would appreciate that, okay? Okay, so also on the Confluence website, we have a form that allows you to submit sort of any other scenarios to us. So we are encouraging everyone, you know, to either call us and let us know if you have some ideas on additional scenarios, or you can certainly use the link on the website and send us any information that you have. And so we will be, again, meeting on February 17th. Before that time, we will be sending out a link to you to provide some feedback on existing scenarios that we've developed. So look out for that from us, okay? And then just, you know, as a reminder, we have all of the resources posted on the Confluence website. So everything that we've discussed today, as well as all the other scenarios, are all posted there for you to review. And that's sort of the upcoming meeting schedule. So I think with that, I'm going to wrap up. And thank you, everyone. We appreciate all of the inputs. I think we've got some really nice ideas on additional scenarios that we can potentially build out with your assistance. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
This concludes today's conference. We thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.